T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Joe Sheehan.
I don't know if you read what Joe Sheehan wrote.
I did.
Baseball America, SI, and the Joe Sheehan newsletter.
Into right center, back of the warning track, the wall, it is gone!
He writes what Dan reads.
Reading is good.
Joe Sheehan with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Let's talk some baseball with Joe Sheehan as we do every Tuesday. Joe Day on The Score. Sheehan at 10, Madden at noon. Joe Sheehan is on Twitter at Joe_Sheehan, SI, Baseball America, and the Joe Sheehan subscription newsletter. He is with us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. So the Cubs' little honeymoon of bum slaying comes to an end, and here are the Dodgers, the team that vanquished them in the playoffs, and there are some who feel that the Cubs never really quite recovered from that tailspin. What do we make of the significance of this series early on?
Well, certainly a test for the Cubs, who I believe they played the Toledo Mudhens for a week, it felt like, took advantage of that to kind of get back in what's a muddled NL Central race. But now the Dodgers are no joke, guys. I mean, the raw numbers are there. They're, you know, one of the best offensive teams in baseball. They crush right-handers. Cody Bellinger off to the great start. You guys like Jock Peterson having big years. It's a tough challenge for the rotation, I think, because you got a team that doesn't swing. They're only the Angels swing at fewer pitches. But when the Dodgers do swing, they have one of the best contact rates in baseball. That's a really tough team to beat that can wait you out and then still square up the baseball.
Cody Bellinger has been absolutely terrific. There was a little blip in his career, early, young as it is, early on. What has he seemingly fixed, and how has he become indestructible?
Well, yeah, it is a heater. I mean, you want to be careful about in getting too excited about a guy. But you know, this is somebody who came up at 21 and was a terrific power hitter. And even last year, he wasn't a bad player. I think the key this year for him has been the contact rate. Somebody who struck out about 25% of his plate appearances last year, he's cut that down to about 12% this year. Now I'm not sure that number's going to hold, because you're talking about, at that point, you're talking about guys walking more than he's striking out.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a Jody Votto type number. But if even cutting the strikeout rate a bit turns him into a 300 hitter, lets him get to that power in games a bit more. And this is the guy we thought he could be a couple of years ago. So I really would take last year as just, you know, a developmental thing. One of the things we do now is if a young player doesn't become Mike Trout, like an MVP candidate for the first 3 years of his career, we almost forget about him. And Bellinger's path is a little more normal.
We saw Tyler Chatwood look like a baseball player. I think when he had come up on this segment before, you said you'd move on from him, that there's really no value there. You might be well off cutting him. But I'll tell you something. It was weird for me to see his pitches in the context of actually sequenced and scheduled properly. The stuff was there. There was swing and miss stuff. And should I allow myself to be at all tantalized?
Yeah, you should. And I'm going to push back a little bit on that, Dan. I actually wrote about Chatwood in the RotoWire Baseball magazine this winter, flagging him as somebody you might want to pick up. Uh-huh. I saw definitely between the raw stuff and the fact that last year just blew up on him. Last year was so bad, you almost kind of write it off and say, get a fresh start this year. Now, the command wasn't really there in the bullpen, and that was the surprise. Only two walks. You mentioned the swing and misses. He got 8 swing and misses on Sunday. The pitching line, 6 shutout innings, was probably a little better than he actually pitched. But again, the velocity was there. It was 95 with the 4-seamer, 95 with the 2-seamer. He got ground balls. He got the 2 double plays. They don't need him in the rotation right now with Lester coming back, but that's a pretty good 6 starter. And that's for where the Cubs are right now. If Chatwood turns into that guy, kind of the role that Mike Montgomery has played in recent seasons, that's a pretty valuable pitcher.
Yeah, the question, though, is that is really a minimal role if he's not going to have any other middle leverage or higher leverage responsibilities somewhere in the bullpen. It's great to have, but could he, in your world, work himself into a position of trust where it's like, all right, go get him. You're coming in. It's the fifth, and we need an out.
I'd want to see more because he's never been used that way before. Remember, he's been a starting pitcher, and then last year he was just banished to low leverage pitching down the stretch. He's never really been used in a second and third two outs type situation. I would be uncomfortable taking a pitcher who's just now working himself back to being good at the role that he's nominally his role, and suddenly trying to turn him into something else. I think if the Cubs can get him to be a league average pitcher in those lower leverage roles, multi-inning reliever, spot starter, guy who fills in when somebody gets hurt, I think that's probably the best you can hope for. I would rather turn him into a starter in that type of role, although I don't know who you'd bump, or go to a six-man rotation before I try to turn him into a high leverage reliever.
So, Joe, on Saturday, Javi Baez doubles. He takes the extra base, and David Bote singles him home for them to win the game. And I was talking about exactly this, what I'm going to ask you about, with my friends while it was happening, so I was made to look a fool. It happens a lot, I guess. But I was thinking about how many strikeouts are in baseball right now, how many home runs are happening in baseball, too. And I was wondering about how teams view that extra 90 feet going from second to third, or going from first to third on something to the right side that you've got the ability for a fast base runner to turn it around. Are we living in a baseball where it's less valuable or maybe too reckless to go for that extra 90 feet in instances? Not saying always, just most times over the large sample size, if so many home runs are happening and so many events that don't score you from second base anyway, if it's just going to be a home run, everybody's in scoring position.
And if the outs are going to be unproductive outs, remember, you mentioned the strikeout rate. We all been talking about the strikeout rate for years. That's going up. And also the pop-up rate is now up. So, a fly ball, with pop-ups now, teams are hitting more pop-ups than they ever have before. So non-productive outs are making a big part of it. And also of the hits that are gotten, singles make up the singles are at an all-time low. It's harder to hit a single now than it's been at any time in baseball history. So you put all that together, Connor, and you're absolutely right. It doesn't make as much sense to go from second to third. Second to third is really the big one. And I wince every time I see a team. It used to be don't make the first or the third out at third base. Now it's don't make any outs at third base. If you look, and I'm not going to read a chart because I know how great – I know that's great radio, but I'm not going to do it. But if you look at the run expectancy charts, which you can find on Prospectus, and Tango Tiger has published some, what you see is that over time, the difference between being on moving up 90 feet gets smaller over time. And first, it's as small now as it's ever been. So, where to be, there was a real advantage in advancing those 90 feet, not necessarily giving up an out for them in the case of a sacrifice bunt, but at least stealing a base, taking the extra base. It's just not there anymore. It's a very small gain relative to the potential loss of the out. So, yeah, Connor, you're absolutely right. It's the increase in strikeouts, the increase in pop-ups, but mostly it's the disappearance of the single. And the disappearance of the single in a game that all of the strategies are kind of predicated on the next guy hitting a single,
right,
has really changed the way we watch baseball.
It's fascinating to think about, because that 90 feet, going from second to third on a wild pitch or something like that, like, that's the play that feels like it wins playoff games. That's the play that feels like it gets you from the wild card game into the next round.
It's the home run.
It just might not be. It might be in game because the next guy throws another wild pitch or something. But that's the difference between some of this 30,000 feet view and then sitting in the 300 level.
Well, and any given game, weird stuff can happen, and you can go single, stolen base, sacrifice bunt, sacrifice fly, and every color announcer loses their mind because this is the way baseball is supposed to be played. But as you mentioned, at the 30,000-foot level, first base is scoring position. Home plate is scoring position.
Yeah.
The difference, we do all these stats, right? How do you hit with runners in scoring position? But really, those numbers don't mean as much as they did 30 years ago when we first started collecting them.
Putting a couple threads together here, you mentioned the name Joey Votto earlier on in one description, and now you talk about the pop-up rate going up. It can't be mere coincidence that Joey Votto's ridiculous streak of not popping out to his first base counterpart in his entire career came to an end this season. I believe he still has some other pop-up streaks going, like not popping out to pitcher, not popping out to catcher, something ridiculous like that. So is there any meaning there? And I always love just talking about Joey Votto because he's so damn fascinating and fun.
There was a great article. C. Trent Rosenkrantz did an interview with Votto after that game, I believe it was, over the Athletic, and people should definitely look that up. I'm a little concerned about Votto, who's been one of the most fun players to watch over the last decade. An MVP winner, a candidate in other years, somebody who has a cerebral approach at the plate. But if you look at the last 2 years, the power went away last year. He dropped 12 home runs, really didn't drive the ball at a .419 slugging. And then this year, guys, all of a sudden, he's striking out a ton. And he's never been somebody who has these really high strikeout rates. And he struck him out. Okay, I'm a professional talker. He struck out in more than 20% of his plate appearances. And it's really awkward to watch. He's only walked 7 times. I do wonder if we're starting to see the beginning of the decline phase. The pop-up is kind of like the moment you go, but when it gets you to look at Votto's track record now over the last 2 years and say, this looks like a player who's in decline. I'd like to believe it's not the case, but we forget just how thin the line is. You know, we talk about these guys, but the line is just so very thin between being able to hit 95 and being overpowered by 95.
Makes my fantasy draft hate it even more now. I'm looking at, Joe, we talked about some of the new rules this year in baseball and the one trade deadline at the end of July. I kind of have to remind myself once a week that that's a thing, that we're actually doing that. Do you imagine that because Dallas Keuchel and Craig Kimbrell are still free agents, that affects this trade market in any way, seeing that this one is the first different one and those two guys are out there for just the money? I mean, there's draft pick comp, but like just the money and none of your own prospects. Do you think that we're going to get kind of weird or maybe earlier trades than normal because of those couple of factors?
I don't know that we'll get earlier trades than normal, although there's always been that advantage of being the first mover and getting the guy for, say, 4 months instead of two.
Yeah.
I don't think Kimbrel and Keuchel affected all that much. You're talking about, Kimbrel might make you 1 to 2 wins better. Keuchel might make you 2 to 3 wins better. And even those numbers are, full season type numbers. I don't think the presence of those guys will affect the trade market. And I even assume that they're out there after the draft, when the draft to compensation goes away. So no, I don't think the presence of those two guys on the market. I think it'll be like most years. What is the mix of buyers and sellers, and do the sellers, particularly in this age of of tanking, have enough value to create an actual trade market?
Well, that's what's so weird right now. I mean, obviously it's super early, but you've got teams like the Red Sox and teams like the Cubs at 500.
How about the Yankees being insanely injured?
So hurt. Teams that would otherwise be going for it. You can't, expecting some sort of massive sell-off of talent would be difficult, and then no one gives a damn what the Orioles have because everyone on that team is bad, and they're not interested in anyone that's selling off from the Orioles.
Right. If you're looking at the 11 teams that started the year, like they basically took the winter off. Some of those teams the Royals don't have a whole lot, especially since they signed Whit Merrifield. The Rangers, Shin-Soo Chu maybe. They signed Jose Leclerc. They're not going to trade him. There are a lot of teams that are either just so talent devoid they can't contribute to a market, or they're in a position like, say, the Padres, where even though we don't expect them to be part of a race, they're probably not going to be in sell mode because they're trying to win in 2020 anyway.
We've been asking this question. It just came up during the morning transition because of something the White Sox did on their broadcast last night. Joe Sheehan, what is the first music concert you went to?
I don't remember which one was first, but both of them are embarrassing, so I'll give up both of them.
Okay.
One was Sheena Easton at Jones Beach. And let's remember, this was like in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And the other was a bunch of like these hip hop, I don't know what we call it then, dance music artists, Stevie B, the Cover Girls, and Alta Dustin at some club in Manhattan. And again, this would have been 87 or 88.
Okay.
All right.
There you have it. That's Sheena Easton.
Music conversations are bad with me, guys. They're just bad. I'll get you somebody from Matthew Leach from MLB.com. He can talk music with you all day.
But do you still have a Sheena Easton album?
I think I got rid of all my vinyl in my last move. So yeah, but I definitely did have a Sheena Easton vinyl somewhere in a box from that era.
Outstanding stuff as
You're
always.
You're never having me back on.
This is the idea.
Now going to bring you on with Sheena Easton. Though.
No, because Connor's you show the age differences here. Mine was the Violent Femmes at the Aragon Ballroom. And Connor's was Blink 182
with Bad Religion opening. That's my OG cred though.
Yeah, I was very much a both a top 40 guy and then moved kind of like we did dance music. My cousin was a DJ. And then I got into hip hop when I went to college.
But the fact that
the whole like Violent Femmes and all that alternative stuff just completely missed me.
The proximity to Manhattan, though, or the fact that you could like wander into CBGB's or something and see like the Ramones in, you know, 1978 or something.
No, I was the nerd in high school, dude. I was the guy who was like going to high school and then going home and studying or playing Stratomatic with my friends. I wasn't a music guy at all until, like I said, you know, college. I got into hip hop a bit, but no, that was, and yeah, I think if you say, oh, you're a kid who grew up in New York in the 80s, you must have had all these experiences. Nope, I was a nerd.
Nope, I was stealing bases with Wee Willie Keeler.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, fellas. Take care.
That is Joe Sheehan, brought to you by Goodwill. Every time you shop at Goodwill, you wield the power to put people to work. Every purchase enables Goodwill to help someone develop a resume, learn interview skills, or get a job. You shop, they train, people work. Visit AmazingGoodwill.com for a Goodwill store near you. Midday Midway, come up. What you got?
I got a heist of something that didn't think had value and probably didn't need to be heisted in the first place. We'll also talk about the worst pizza topping of all time.
I like pineapple by itself, but not I have a reason why Connor will never be president of Liberia.
Oh, and, yeah. Well, that was my mistake.
It's beyond the fact that he's not Liberian. I've got a loss of a piece of aviation history, and I've got a real estate opportunity for you.
The Midday Midway's on the way. Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Talk some baseball to start this show, looking at the Cubs and the Dodgers and what that series means. Talk about the anniversary of the Fernando Tatis 2 grand slams in one inning against the same pitcher that happened 20 years ago on this date. A little bit about Jake Arrieta exercising some outright leadership of the Philadelphia Phillies and chastising his teammate Bryce Harper for getting thrown out of a game in which they needed him to be in that game. And we talked about a lot of stuff with Joe Sheehan as well.
This is from the emails from Mitch category, making his way into the Midday Midway yet again. This one was just a classic Mitch email, just the link to an article right in the subject line with no subject in the email whatsoever. This from Men's Health. Apparently, the more expletives you use, the bigger your overall vocabulary and potentially your intellect. Yeah. Researchers at Marist College and the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, which... come on, let's be more stereotypically here. Really? Marist and Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts are going to do this study? Good for you guys. Way to shake the stereotypes. They asked volunteers to quickly fire off as many words as they could in several categories, including animals, words that began with a certain letter, and obscenities. Both in speaking and in writing, people who rattled off more G-rated words were also able to name more curse words as well. The people who have a lot of words have a lot of swear words. This puts one big myth that people who swear because they don't have better alternatives to pasture, says the study and the results of it. In fact, holding a full arsenal of swear words might actually serve as a marker of intelligence, since knowing and correctly using a wide range of terms demonstrates your intellectual capabilities.
All right.
Benefits of swearing included, according to this study, it can decrease pain. It can help you fit in.
That explains Terry.
And it can win you an argument. Was Terry in a lot of pain always? Because that explains a lot of the swearing.
Why he was swearing all the time.
I thought it was fairly interesting. I have always bemoaned the fact that we can't swear as much as I'd like to on the show because of the, you know, FCC thing. But it's probably a good rule one way or another. With swearing, though, some of your favorites can be used in almost every instance. I mean, that's the whole basis of one of them, is that you can put it anywhere in a sentence, and it just kind of fits. That's maybe my favorite word.
If you're in the market for a house, I've got one for you, and I had never heard of this before, but apparently Bolskine House is available, and it's on Loch Ness. And it's a famous home. It's really just kind of the shell of a house right now because it burned out in 2015. And the selling agent is Galbraiths. And there's an article, a BBC piece here. So I'm a little confused as to how this all went down, but there's a huge story here that the Boleskine house was purchased by somebody named Aleister Crowley. I don't know if you ever heard of Aleister Crowley.
Heard the name. I can't pin
it. All right.
Well,
he purchased the house for the purpose of conducting a ritual that required very specific architecture. He wanted to raise the dead and demons and devils, and he had all kinds of experiments with black magic and the dark arts. And he says to have summoned 115 spirits, including Lucifer.
Oh.
Using the rites of Abramelin the Mage.
That's what I use.
The summoning of the 12 kings and dukes of hell, the chanting sacrifice of cats and goats and sodomy.
Shushing the blood.
And all of it. And the apparently, this goes even before he owned the house. There was owned by, it was Colonel Archibald Fraser, who built it on the charred remains of a church. And it was said to be haunted at that point. And Crowley then bought it in 1899 when he was 23.
So the names of our Satanists are Archibald Crowley and Alistair what now? It's a real tough name.
Alistair Crowley.
Sorry, yeah, and Archibald. Yeah, great.
Archibald Fraser.
Yep.
And then Crowley sold Boleskine House in 1913. In 1960, it was owned by Major Edward Grant, who killed himself with a shotgun after the housekeeper had a premonition of suicide. It was a filmmaker, Kenneth Anger, spent the summer of 1969 in the house when he witnessed a heavy painting float off the wall and come to rest on the floor. The following year, in 1970, it was bought by Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, who was fascinated
Perfect.
By Aleister Crowley.
Perfect.
And he lived there for a while. And then his childhood friend Malcolm Dent moved in and restored it. It then burned in 2015. And then, I mean, this just keeps going with everybody talking about the various hauntings and beings, etc. And it can be yours for £510,000. The unholy home and 23 acres of cursed land on Loch Ness. That's how it's being marketed. If you're interested, you can contact the agency Galbraiths, who is selling it.
I like this from the 262. Maybe that's Scorehouse Part 2.
Scorehouse.
That's where we
are conjuring the dead. Connor's falling on his head.
Be a great place to fire it up one more time. Police say a Central Virginia man made off with a whopper of a haul from Burger King. Hundreds of gallons used cooking grease.
You can run cars on it.
But he couldn't give police the slip and now faces grand larceny charges. News outlets report that Alvaro Mendez Flores of Richmond admitted to the April 4th theft. Court documents state Mendez Flores backed his truck up to the grease dumpster outside the shopping center, used a hose to begin siphoning the used oil into a 1,600-gallon tank. Cooking grease can be used to make biodiesel fuel. Grease thefts have increased as biodiesel prices have risen. Police noted six such thefts in Fairfax County over the past year. Mendez Flores told police he would get paid 25 cents a gallon for the stolen oil. I didn't know that the heist number was up for used grease. I mean, he knew biodiesel was getting thrown into the mix a whole lot here, but I didn't think it was that kind of money.
Yeah, the best reason to do it is you get cars that smell like French fries.
Is that what ends up happening?
Apparently, they drive by, like, oh, what's that smell? It's that car.
I mean, you can do that for like $2.99. I was going to say, like, $2.99 and set them on the seat next to you.
Stealing your bit. Yep.
Eat a handful of them. It would have gotten them $300 to $400 per heist. I just can't. Well, it's got to take you a while to siphon 1,600 gallons out of a tank and into your own truck.
Depends on the diameter of the siphon and what you're...
And your ability. I mean, right? If he's a practiced grease siphoner,
started.
Then you've got some lung capacity
Go
to you.
Go grease siphon, you're burning up the sun. I apologize for nothing. A spokesman says Liberia's president is working from home.
Library.
This one easy trick. You too could work from home.
After two snakes were found in the building that contains his office.
Yeah.
Deputy Press Secretary Smith Toby tells the Associated Press that former international soccer star and President George Weah was told to stay away until the Foreign Affairs building can be fumigated. The black snakes were seen this week briefly emerging from a hole in a wall of the building's reception area. Liberia is home to poisonous snakes, and officials are not taking chances. It should be venomous, right, AP, not poisonous. Poisonous means...
I'm unaware. I kind of run away from whatever snake.
I believe poisonous means you shouldn't... You can't eat them. Venomous means they can inject you with toxin via their
snake
fangs.
Snake means run away.
The deputy press secretary says fumigation has begun to take care of crawling and creeping things. The president was FIFA's 1995 Player of the Year. He assumed the presidency in January of 2018. But, yeah, if somebody said they saw a couple of what could be black mambas...
I'm out.
...go in, yeah, I've seen Kill Bill. I've seen what happens with the black mamba when it bites Michael Madsen in the face a couple times.
I'm out. I want nothing to do with it.
Just ask the librarian.
It's Liberia. This from Springtown, Texas. A North Texas Mr. Jim's Pizza. Ever been? Ever heard of it?
Mr. Jim's?
Mr. Jim's Pizza.
No.
Has been temporarily shut down after health inspectors found that three employees put a laxative onto pizza that was eaten by another employee. Police in Springtown, located in Wise and Parker counties, said the incident happened at the pizza place around 8 p.m. on a Friday. A resident told police an employee at the Mr. Jim's posted on social media that they were putting the laxative, Miralax, on the food. They posted on social media that they were going to do this real clever trick, then did it, then got caught. Police said officers went to the business, found that the three employees put Miralax onto at least one pizza, and then another employee unknowingly ate it. According to police, the employee who ate the tainted pizza is now, of course, sick. Mr. Jim's is forced to shut down until it's expected on Monday. That was this Monday. No word as to whether or not they got all the Miralax out, but how dumb can you be to A, want to do this, B, execute it, and C, put the damn thing on social media before you get it done?
A fire broke out Monday after a twin-engine plane crashed inside a state prison complex in Norco, California. The crash was reported at 12:10 p.m. at the California Rehabilitation Center. The plane went down in an area of the prison currently under construction. Reports from the scene initially indicated it was a Cessna, but Federal Aviation Administration says it was a Northrop N9M aircraft, the last of its kind. If you know anything, if you know your airplanes, the N9M was a flying wing.
Oh, cool.
Developed in the 1940s, and it was a really cool-looking thing, and it was restored. There was a pilot preparing for the upcoming Chino Air Show, and an eyewitness said, I looked up, and I saw bright yellow going side to side, spun around, and went nose-first into the ground. And I had a mordant laugh, because they show the wreckage. They show what's left of the wreckage.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing. There's barely a charred perimeter of what was the plane was completely disintegrated, entirely burned up. There's just a hole in the ground. And then, of course, the reporter says the condition of the pilot was not updated. We're waiting for the NTSB to let us know. And like, hey, man, that pilot, it's bad. Yeah, because that pilot is disintegrated. The condition of that pilot is pulverized. Oh. There's nothing left. There's nothing there. But this was the last of these restored single wings that were all the rage in the 40s. Remember the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark? That the Germans had a version
that's
of the single
right.
wing.
That's a single was
that
right.
That is. And that's when the giant prop comes around and takes out the strong man. He did a bunch of strawberry jam that gets thrown up against the plane.
Did you know that the strong man that Indy knocks out there in front of the plane, it's the same guy that he shoots who's wielding the scimitar or whatever?
No.
That, yeah, same dude, same stuntman.
Really?
Same guy.
And you know the story behind that.
Yeah, there Harrison was Ford had
diarrhea.
Dysentery, something. Yeah,
there was
he had diarrhea or something.
There was supposed to be a sword
big
fight.
Big sword fight.
Big
the whole
scimitar
thing.
Battle.
Spielberg had scripted it out, and Lucas had, unsurprisingly, the both of them had contrived this really elaborate sword fight thing that was going to last way too long and make you question why you were sitting there still. But no, Harrison Ford just pulled out the gun and shot him because he was too tired. Same guy. That guy and the big German that he knocks out 30 minutes later. That is the Midday Midway. We do it every day here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. James Fegan's coming up at 10:40. We're going to check in on him with the latest for the White Sox. Don't forget, Who's Your Guy, day two. That is at 11:20. Have your guys prepared.
The bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago. Your Central Division champion Chicago Wolves and Grand Rapids split the first two games of the Calder Cup playoffs first round. For up-to-date playoff information or tickets, visit ChicagoWolves.com. James Fegan wrote a piece about Tim Anderson and the word that he used, and he wrote from his unique perspective that allowed him some insight that we're not available to us.
So James is next, and we will discuss it with him. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
Two and two. He struck him out, and the Sox win the opener, hammering the Orioles 12-2. A good night for the Sox all around.
And they're entitled. Why not? They're allowed to go up against a really bad baseball team and have a really
beat the hell out of them.
Really,
yeah, that's fine.
Nice night, sure. This segment's brought to you by Patrick Cadillac, and James Fegan joins us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. You can follow James on Twitter at @JRFegan. What's going on, James? How are you?
I'm good, and you?
Wonderful, hanging in, watching Tim Anderson achieve heights that that he kind of expected, but I find the guy's performance to be absolutely breathtaking. And I guess when looking at Tim, amidst everything that surrounded him the first couple weeks of this season, I was reading through some of the things he seems to have changed, and it's his ability to hit sliders, his ability to identify them and then hit them at a level that he's not done before. I'm sure the batting average in balls in play, that kind of 500 number-ish, that'll probably come down some. But he seems a different hitter to me, and I wonder what you have attributed that to over the last couple of weeks and spring training as well.
Well, the last time I talked to him about it, he accused me of trying to get his secrets.
But, sure, because you could use those then.
I think his swing kind of has more physical ability to allow him to, like, I mean, it's not like he necessarily is recognizing a slider in a fundamentally different way now, but he kind of has a lot more, patience with his load in his swing that allows him to maybe pause and stay back on the ball when he does recognize a slider, whereas, earlier versions of his swing, it was just kind of a binary swing or don't swing, and he didn't really have an ability to adjust the velocity or kind of make any changes in what he was seeing, and that, basically reduced to a dead red fastball hitter because, he had the bat speed to catch on it. And that was kind of the only mode he was ever really geared into, was just to swing on a fastball. But now he kind of has that little pause when he recognizes spin that he can kind of stay back and shoot some singles into right field and, even catch a couple for power if they're hangers.
What are you seeing from starting pitching trends right now? It's just kind of been it's been directionless at this point. You're getting good start, bad start from a guy, average start. I don't have a feel for the overall level of starting for the White Sox.
Yeah, and I didn't really anticipate it to be a strength coming in. If anything, I've been kind of encouraged with Rodon, because just to see the swinging strike come back, because that's a guy who you tout as being kind of stuff over command, and to see him with his like career low strikeout rate after coming off of surgery last year was really worrisome. He's gotten a lot of that from just, throwing his slider an absolute ton, but, even that wasn't necessarily working last season. Now that he's able to command the strike grabber early in the counts, he's able to get whiffs off of it. He still hasn't gotten his top velocity back. And I don't know necessarily if it's a reasonable expectation to have him do that at any point, but I think he can be an effective pitcher, just kind of throwing a slider, 40% of the time. Ronaldo, he started the season completely command out of whack, and that's not really encouraging, seeing as he was kind of the best pitcher last year, especially during the second half. It seemed like they've righted the ship, but, consistency is, what you're looking for constantly with young players. So that's certainly true with Ronaldo, who's just kind of a raw stuff guy, and you want to know if he's going to be able to basically be the guy he was the last 2 months for an entire year. This season's mostly showed that that's probably going to wax and wane out depending on how much his mechanics are in place. And with Giolito, you literally had him looking good as ever, and then he hurts himself. So that kind of defines the up and down nature of his season.
Is he expected to miss a handful? Where's his health at most recently?
It's kind of the general dichotomy of the player who thinks he's going to be back immediately and, and, you know, come back on the 10-day minimum and miss one start. And the team that, you know, by putting Manny Benoist in the rotation, clearly is more prepared in case that doesn't happen. Last check, he had not thrown like a full out bullpen at max effort and seeing how his leg responded, but he's had no pain really since it happened. He's been, you know, playing catch since it happened, and he wanted to be back after one start. Certainly their depth is not really, you know, unless they just decide that they're not going to slow play Dylan Cease, which I don't think they are. Their depth is not really in place to, you know, sustain themselves with a long absence from him.
Talking White Sox with James Fegan of The Athletic. Follow him on Twitter at JR Fegan. This is the Bernstein and McKnight show here on 670 The Score. I appreciated very much what you wrote about Tim's one game suspension. I appreciated the perspective you found from Lucas Giolito to put in there, and I appreciated very much your own perspective on the suspension. Wonder if you have talked to either Tim or the White Sox or anybody around there who was part of the decision to just take the suspension the next day and move on. I found that, I don't know, I wondered if there was a purpose to that.
I think, you know, in his heart of hearts, Tim would probably not rather be kind of the center of a whole debate. I mean, he kind of gets caught in these things by happenstance, not really something he would want to be himself, but it kind of, you know, circumstances kind of drag him into things like this rather than he'd really want to be, you know, the flashpoint of the entire league. I mean, he would describe even the bat flipping incident as not something that he's not trying to start some movement, but just something he did in the moment. You know, I still think, like, the Major League Baseball ignored a ton of context and shouldn't really be coming down on them the way that they did. And combined with the whole, you know, much of the league kind of supporting the idea that he should get beaned for being himself, and that how, what a terrible look that is when that's the, you know, the only African player on a team and with such a sparse African-American population league in general. But I don't think Tim was necessarily wanting to take some huge stand on that he should get to say the N-word during games all the time or anything like that. I think he acknowledges that that's probably not ideal for a mass market entertainment product, but you know, he just keeps kind of getting dragged into these battles because MLB is incompetent more than he actually wants to be the center of it.
You did a very careful job of trying to handle some of this context, but I was trying to be in the minds of MLB in how, what would I do? How would I handle it if something like this happened? Because it's like, it's sort of this uncharted territory of, you know, black guy calls white guy the N-word, and you think, you know, if you're baseball, it's, you would face all kinds of backlash for ignoring it, and you would be like, well, why is it okay for this? And you can't, those discussions say, all right, how much time do you have? We can sit down and actually really talk about what's okay and what's not okay, and what words signify and how they signify and to whom, and how there are different scales for who's using certain words to mean certain things. Talk about the semiotics of everything, and next thing you know, everybody's asleep or they've left, and you can't do that. You can't have these discussions. I don't think baseball had a choice. I really don't. I think that all they could do, backed into where they were, was say, yeah, let's just say no one. It's best off for everybody that nobody uses the word, while completely understanding that there's a whole lot of discussion to be had by some very smart people about what it all means.
I mean, it seems like a weird entry point, especially for regulating kind of speech during base bench clearing brawls. From my understanding, if they wanted to start delving into the language used during bench clearing brawls, they'd have a lot of suspensions to hand down. And, you know, this wasn't something that was necessarily public, or that, you know, I heard a lot of the Royals raising stink that he should be suspended because of it. And maybe if, like, this is shock and aghast, it's the first time that they've heard this, like, word thrown out in a heated dispute, maybe it just shows a testament to how few black players that they have in the league, because it just seemed like a weird point. I don't know what was really forcing their hand to get in, because it wasn't something anybody was discussing until they were trying to figure out why Tim Anderson was suspended.
It seems to me that somebody's got to want to tell somebody that this is what he said. Like you mentioned,
yeah.
If you went through all the bench-clearing brawls, you'd have to, A, go through a whole lot of words that I'm sure baseball doesn't want said, and you'd have to go through multiple languages, and I just don't think they've done that. They found the easiest way to do this and found a completely tone-deaf way to administer any kind of justice.
I think that's a great point. We talk about multiple languages because the whole language issue, if certain people in their language or in their dialect of their language, because the way words are used among Dominican players isn't the same way words are used among Cuban players or Puerto Rican players even, let alone we start talking about Japanese and Korean players. I hadn't really thought of it in that way, that this could be a larger language police concern.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you that much just from how much trouble my Colombian wife has, like, understanding Jose Abreu, that the dialects are very different. So, there's a lot to parse, and even from, you know, just chatter in locker rooms as far as, like, language policing, I feel like they're biting off more than they can chew.
When you look at what's made of Jose Abreu over the first couple of weeks, he gets a couple of hits against an Orioles team that we mentioned off the top isn't a very good ball club. What is Jose Abreu in the context of the 2019 White Sox?
What do you mean? He's a slow starting first baseman.
Yeah, and kind of slow in general. I mean, we've made that team has made so much about his leadership ability and what he means to Yoan Moncada. He seems to stand for more than just slow starting first baseman to them. Do you get the sense that they continue to feel that way, or is it all going to change?
I definitely think they would probably lean towards thinking of him as someone who's around for a few more years, but. Yeah, I actually think that they're being cautious and kind of evaluating, you know, just how much longevity he's really going to have, how reliable he is for someone to maybe, you know, add a nice little two or three additional years as a, you know, clubhouse steward and reliable middle order presence, you know, as a big kind of hulking first baseman who's kind of, you know, uncharacteristic slumps are getting more frequent and longer over the last couple of years. It's definitely a situation where they probably – shouldn't leap into necessarily an extension and definitely use the season to monitor him. I would still think that he's probably just because of the mentorship aspect and the fact that they've been unwilling really to trade him for anything what other teams would consider reasonable, that they probably are leaning towards holding him on a longer-term basis. But I definitely think his cold start slump should be watched closely.
James Fegan, thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks to James.
All right. Very good. That was James Fegan of The Athletic, who covers the White Sox. And the top of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago. Your Central Division champion Chicago Wolves and Grand Rapids split the first two games in the Calder Cup playoffs first round. For up-to-date playoff information or tickets, visit ChicagoWolves.com. You've got a toy that you've been playing with over there.
What are you talking about?
You put your name in the thing.
Oh yeah, that whole thing. It's fun. SB Nation has done something fun and funny for the NFL draft. I can get Dan Bernstein's draft profile up and ready to go for you.
I don't get it.
I can get mine and Jay Zawoski's and Rick Camp's and Ray Diaz's and Adam Studzinski's too. We've got to make your own draft profile creator here. It's funny, and we'll get it for you when we come back. Also, I'm thinking about the draft a little bit differently, and I know that you are too. There was a piece out in The Ringer about the stuff and the way that individual teams are going about and trying to identify prospects for the upcoming draft and how different it is now than ever before. That's where we're headed. Before, who's your guy at 11:20? Day two is coming up in just a few. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.